Shakespeare famously wrote in Henry VI, "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers." As the son, grandson, and son-in-law of lawyers, and as someone who signed up for the law boards and never took them, lawyer jokes have a special frisson for me. But courts of law can be impassioned, dramatic settings, and lawyers, in novels and films and plays, are often our heroes. In Inherit the Wind, the court battle is over teaching evolution in school in the 1920s, but the lawyer character played by Spencer Tracy in the movie is fighting for something even bigger, the freedom to think.
"And soon, Your Honor, with banners flying and with drums beating, we'll be marching backward, backward, through the glorious ages of that 16th century, when bigots burned the man who dared bring enlightenment and intelligence to the human mind.
I hope counsel does not mean to imply that this court is bigoted."
"Well, Your Honor has the right to hope."
Law can be about the fundamentals, as art can be. That's why Shelley said that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. And that's why writers and other storytellers today are drawn to tales of justice. Today, we're looking at the law and art and design. My guest is the novelist Scott Turow. In 1987, he published his first legal thriller, Presumed Innocent, and he has written five more bestsellers since then, including Reversible Errors, which came out last fall. And he still practices criminal law in Chicago, where he grew up. Scott Turow, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. I'm really pleased to be here with you.
You wanted to be a writer, I understand, before you wanted to be a lawyer. How did you make that zig or zag into law?
My interest in the law really came as a great surprise. I am the son of a doctor who, as I often say, was a prophet in his own time, in that he hated lawyers long before it was fashionable for doctors to do so. And because of the way he talked about lawyers, I had never any thought of being one of those creatures. I always wanted to be a novelist. And I was sort of shocked when I went to I had a fellowship at the Creative Writing Center at Stanford and ended up spending 5 years there. And I was amazed that the friends I was making were as often lawyers as writers, that my college roommates had gone to law school, and I was greatly intrigued by what they were doing. And finally, I noticed that the novel I was working on with such labor was also about the law. And I thought the world was telling me something.
What was the world telling you? Why did lawyers and the law fascinate you so much as a young man?
I think my personality is organized around certain core issues about the uses of power. And the just application of power and the unjust. And obviously those questions are at the very heart of the law. And for that reason, legal questions intrigue not only the 24 or 25-year-old, but the 54-year-old who's still sitting here.
And then you became a lawyer, and you were a successful lawyer. And then you became a very successful novelist. And yet, you still practice law.
Right.
How come?
Basically, because of what I just said. I find the law intriguing, and not so much in the practice, which, as everybody knows, can be stressful and vexing, but the questions involved are often of great interest. And I enjoy being involved with those questions. I enjoy the legal community in Chicago at large. And obviously, I work in a law firm, the Sun and Shine firm, where I happen to have lots of friends, and I enjoy seeing them. You know, there are personal aspects of this as well. It's a very comfortable thing for me. But I really do like the enterprise.
You have pretty much single-handedly refined and perfected a genre of legal thriller. But I read that you were not much of a mystery fan growing up. How did you come to write what can be called, I guess, mysteries of a kind?
It's not like I didn't read mysteries at all. I certainly read the Hardy Boys and I read Sherlock Holmes. But I wasn't one of those people who reads mysteries exclusively or even predominantly. And I really think overall I was probably more influenced by the Dickens that I read as a young man. Than by mysteries in particular. And, you know, there is something to that adage that every great novel is really a mystery at its core. There's certainly, you know, something that the reader wants to find out, some central issue that that drags the reader forward into the heart of the book. But I think, frankly, I absorbed a lot of mystery plotting from television, which I saw a lot as a child. And I was one of those kids who was glued to the set and whose literacy was predicted to be nil as a result of it. So some of it came from that, you know, much maligned medium.
Your latest novel, Reversible Errors, is fascinating because it's about a subject that I know, especially in Illinois, but everywhere in America, is on people's lips these days, which is the death penalty and capital punishment and whether or not it can be fairly administered. And if you could read a bit of that now, I'd be very grateful. And if you can just set up the passage you're going to read.
Arthur Raven is the lawyer who has been very reluctantly appointed to represent Gandalf in what he regards as the legal equivalent of the administration of last rites. And he has a pretty fixed view of the world of criminal law, which he fled many years before when he was a prosecutor. And this is Arthur's reflections on what goes on in the world of crime. Since leaving the prosecuting attorney's office, Arthur had played defense lawyer infrequently, only when one of the firm's corporate clients or its bosses was suspected of some financial manipulation. The law he lived most days as a civil litigator was a tidier, happier law, where both sides fudged and the issues raised were minuscule matters of economic policy. His years as a prosecutor seemed to be a time when he'd been assigned each day to clean out a flooded basement where coliform bacteria and sewer stink rotted almost everything. Someone had said that power corrupted, but the saying applied equally to evil. Evil corrupted. A single twisted act, some piece of gross psychopathology that went beyond the boundaries of what almost anybody else could envision. A father who tossed his infant out a 10th-floor window, a former student who forced lie down the throat of a teacher, or someone like Arthur's new client who not only killed but then sodomized one of the corpses. The backflow from such acts polluted everyone who came near. Cops, prosecutors, defense lawyers, judges, no one in the face of these horrors reacted with the dispassion the law supposed. There was a single lesson. Things fall apart. Arthur had harbored no desire to return to that realm where chaos was always imminent.
What about that corruption of the proximity to ugliness and evil that you write about there so beautifully? It has always seemed to me to be a kind of unacceptable occupational hazard of being a criminal lawyer on either side.
I think it is a hazard, and I think one has to be honest about, you know, what the attraction is. You know, I'm as a defense lawyer, I've always been conscious of the fact that, you know, I fight like hell for the client, and then at the end, I go home and they go to jail. On the other side, as a prosecutor, you sometimes have to acknowledge your lurid fascination with the antics of criminals and the fact that the difference between them and you is less than the law with its severe punishment likes to imagine. All of these things are really a part of saying, you know, why am I attracted to what makes people misbehave? But the one sort of literary perspective I would add on that is everybody seems to be interested in the question of how evil happens. It's why we read, you know, murder mysteries or watch TV dramas about criminals. Being a criminal lawyer only sort of enlarges what seems to be a fairly natural impulse among everyone.